in Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania, in a particular art gallery, one of the most striking paintings is called The Prude. It depicts the side view of an elderly woman staring out a window, and in the background are religious artifacts. The painting is interesting because the woman is, as you could suggest, universal. She could be from Mullingar, Cork, Portlaoise, or Dublin. And she carries a view, and this is 1939, that there's an awful lot of stuff going on of which she doesn't approve. A striking thing about the gallery's art, and it's important to point this out, is that in this and another very good gallery, paintings, as you would expect, very much reflect the era in which they were created. And of course, there was the violent intrusion of the Nazis and later the Soviets. A picture of the two Graces, one of them naked, is from 1937. An oil painting from 1932 is of a clothes-free woman bathing. But as we move into the Nazi and Soviet periods, joyousness and joie de vivre is largely absent. We, for example, are presented with sturdy workers and the Red Army being cheered on as they march towards the conquering Latvia. Our discussion is, as indicated, about sex and the historical shifts in the content of art generally can perhaps be mirrored in how over the decades we as a society had dealt with sex, love, pleasure and reproduction, and indeed how our ethics surrounding these have altered. Our focus is on ethics. When you ask people who have lived many decades about our society, they will frequently say there is a drift, a lowering of sexual behavior standards, a lack of discipline, and that no ethic has emerged to replace that of the Christian churches, which are largely ignored, especially by the young. They will say there must be barriers, taboos to certain types of behavior, which of course is true, particularly in regard to protecting the young, and that the family of man, woman, and children is being weakened. It is perhaps time, and churches and the wider society have an obligation here, for us to be brave, to seriously debate how we can develop a new sexual ethic, an updated moral paradigm for how we go about our sexual activity. Many of us were brought up to believe that sexual pleasure was only allowed in marriage, and that one married an opposite gender partner who was loved, and then and only then the couple could set about the fun of making children, and of course would stay together until death did them part. But much of that scenario, as we know, is now crumbling. Women are much less likely to stay in intolerable relationships. There is divorce, and the way is open for gay marriage. A very substantial number of people live with their partners without marrying. In a few decades, really, everything changed. Even the Catholic Church eventually shifted its position, which had stated that procreation was the primary purpose of marital sex and that the expression and fostering of love between the couple was secondary. This previous stance was part of the attempt to deny that sexual pleasure was every man and woman's entitlement, to deny, as Wordsworth put it, that pleasure is the tribute we owe to our dignity as human beings. John O'Donoghue believed that this was a profoundly spiritual perspective, Your senses, he said, link you intimately with the divine, within you and around you. The wonderful Mary Oliver, who we've read in Wild Geats, puts pleasure on, as has been described, a heavenly plane. She suggests that we must treat the soft animal of our bodies with kindness. We should allow ourselves to love what we love with feelings that need not always be held in check by rationality. Rather than fight it, we should celebrate and nurture our animal self. However, any attempt to civilize ourselves is often our greatest source of pain, she adds. The body-denying tradition of some branches of Christianity is lamented by Nancy Mayers. You would think, she says, wouldn't you, that a faith found on the premises of the reincarnation would hold in certain respect, perhaps in outright reverence, the body, the very form in which the divine elected to be housed. The world, she says, may well end if you cut down its trees and pave it over. It may well end if you permit its people to be unfed and unclothed and uneducated while you prosper. But the world will not end if you touch your genitals. The world will not end even if you touch someone else's genitals. I can think, she said, of sound reasons not to do so, but fear and disgust should not be among them. Your body is not a pest house, it is simply a body. Who you are, part of God's creation, a small part, true, but as real and lovely as the rest. If you love every part, evil will not enter the world through you. Luther, surprisingly to many perhaps, believed that lovemaking was not only sacred, but delightful. The best place, he said, to be a Christ's second coming was to be united in the act of making love. Through sex, according to Sally Tisdale, an essayist, we are partake of the one experience above all which allows us the bliss of true union. So, what is being intimated up to now is that the body itself and the joys that can ensue from it are to be celebrated, not to be imprisoned in musty religiosity. This is not to suggest that what Mary Oliver calls the soft animal within us should have carte blanche to run wild. Even the ancient Greeks, who had no concept of sex as sin, and for whom the craving for sexual pleasure was an accepted addiction, realized that the dangerous hunger for sex had to be kept in check. Which is why, for them, marriage was a necessity. Women were cloistered at home, often surrounded by guard dogs. After marriage, a main purpose of which was to produce a male heir, women and men often had little to do with each other. It was accepted, too, that men could be bisexual. And the Greeks were skeptical about love, which it was said made them men copulate too often and lose their strength. The incessant physical longing of love was regarded as a disturbance of the body's natural balance, a disease which deprived the mind of its control of the body. The British philosopher A.C. Grayling, who I think died fairly recently, also looks at love with a cynical eye. He tells us that the first phase of what is termed love is a species of frenzy, which the Greeks feared as a punishment from God. And the second phase is a species of intermittent anesthesia, in which numbness makes almost bearable the anxious boredom of parents and the tensions, provocations, and annoyances of living squashed against another person year after year in a small space. He says that whatever name is best appropriate to the reason why a couple stick together through routines of domestic life, moving groceries and children about at frequent intervals, and watching too much TV, it isn't love. Grayling does say, however, that the mutual benefits of living in a committed relationship deserve celebration. But there is an exception, and that is where narrow, ignorant, and ungenerous views of what is accepted in human relationships exclude all but monogamous heterosexuals from the great good that human affections and shared lives offer. So far, we can perhaps agree that bodily pleasure is a good thing, even though there have been contrary voices, that views on the concept of love, as Grayling says, a short phase of sexual infatuation and a long phase of habit and inertia, can change, and that some boundaries are necessary to deal with Mary Oliver's soft animal of our bodies. The question is, what should these boundaries be? Where would we look for at least refreshed protocols for our sexual behavior? Protocols that would enhance humanity. Well, one lead could be from the young. Not because they thought it out. Largely, it seems, they have been led by their hormones. But chats with the psychologists, retired social workers, and people from other professional backgrounds and experience suggest that the young have indelibly decoupled love and sex. Of course, many older people have experienced sex without love, and many young people fall in love. But it is now as often expected that, it is now not now as often expected that, like a horse and carriage, love and sex must go together. For many people, according to Richard Holloway, sex is an appetite to be satisfied with no necessary connection to any kind of relationship. Recreational sex, and he uses another word, is purely functional, pleasurable, and done for its own sake. And if it leads to sexual love and the development of a sexual relationship, a different code of ethics comes into play, requiring exclusivity as well as honesty about other sexual encounters. The emotional connection alters the ethical dynamic in a subtle way, creating a bond that opens each partner to the possibility of harm as a result of the conduct of the other. Any infidelity hurts and damages, and, says Holloway, is therefore wrong. With recreational sex, his thesis goes, there is no relationship to be broken. Now, traditionalists might say that it is wrong to treat sexuality with such triviality. And indeed, many of us may doubt that there is no bond to be broken. But Holloway directs us towards John Harris, who wrote the book Wonder Woman and Superman. Harris wrote, although it's hardly a new idea, that for a moral judgment to be respectable, it must have something to say about just why a supposed wrong action is wrongful. If it fails to meet this test, it is a preference and not a moral judgment. Holloway goes on to say that we may find the idea of recreational sex displeasing, but we ought to be careful about dismissing it as immoral. There is a definite need, he says, for a sense of balance in human sexuality, so that we do not constantly swing between the extremes of abnegation and overindulgence. And whatever guidelines are adopted will have to be applicable also to gay and lesbian people. This goes without saying, but it raises an important strand in establishing a reconsidered framework for sexual activity. Montaigne, who is often quoted, was willing to query what were seen as certainties and prejudices. We should, he said, do something we haven't done before. He was fascinated by change. He loved Ovid's Metamorphoses. People alter. They turn into trees, animals, stars, or disembodied bodies. And he wrote about what he saw as his own sexual inadequacies, his view seemingly being that he had communicated so much about himself, why not the sexual part? So we should maybe be able to think of sex protocols in terms of change, as Montaigne might have done, all of which is against a background that monogamy is the official social norm in only 16% of human societies, and among 850 or so human societies recognized by anthropology, 83% practice polygamy. And another change that needs more understanding and an ethical basis, as does recreational sex, is sexual fluidity. In other words, how over a lifetime the sexual gender preferences of men and women can change. Sabra Katz Wise says that for many of us, changes in our lives are constant, yet it is a misconception that sexual orientation develops at an early age and remains stable throughout one's life. Changes in sexual orientation are a common thread in many people's lives, she says. This is distinct from bisexuality and can be experienced by people of any sexual orientation. ARP, a prominent US organization for people over 50, says that sexual orientation is not carved in stone. A great sadness in life for many people is how, through inertia, cultural background, age, or society's disapproval, they deny themselves or are denied an intimate partner, a partner who would fulfill many of their needs. They lose this opportunity because while a potential relationship may be loving in the widest sense, it would not be seen as what we traditionally regard as love. So perhaps as an antidote to loneliness, if nothing else, should we not encourage meaningful coupledom among men and women, men and men, women and women, even if Cupid misses the ultimate target of love? Should we not take into our ethical paradigm that sexual orientations are not immutable and that love, the ideal of course, and intimate alliances may, to misquote, alter when they alteration find? Indeed, should we not be discussing whether sex is a value in itself, needing boundaries and rules, of course, but an activity and appetite which can stand alone with minimal relationship requirements? A step too far for many, I think. So the suggestion is that we open our minds to new or less understood modes of sexuality and meld them within our ethical thinking. Ralph Helverson, who we've heard from in this church, says there is a persistent disposition to put people in pigeonholes, order them as they ought to be, and then get on with our business. We all have settled opinions that new ideas must confront. Some of these settled opinions are about sex ethics. It is perhaps time for fresh thinking, for inclusion in a revamped framework. Recreational sex, the separation of love and sexual activity, and fluidity. With many thanks.